Hello and welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm Kate Swanell. According to the most recent data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics, 2.3 million Australian women and 1.5 million Australian men took calcium supplements in 2011-12. 5% of Australian adults took vitamin D supplements and 3% took both vitamin D and calcium in 2011-12. How many of those supplements are necessary, effective and safe? The MJA has just published a new narrative review on vitamin D and calcium supplements. One of the authors, Professor Ian Reid from the University of Auckland, is my special guest today. You and your colleague have written a narrative review of both calcium and vitamin D supplements. Why the need to do them together?
Well, I think that's a critical question. The short answer is because the editors asked us to do so. The first point I make in the article is that they're quite different.
And yes.
We should stop running them together because it confuses the issues. And, you know, there are quite a lot of people, particularly, say, frail elderly people in nursing homes, who are vitamin D deficient and do need vitamin D supplements. And vitamin D supplements are cheap. And if you take them in sensible doses, then they're without risk, the same as and without side effects, and the same is not necessarily true of calcium supplements. The idea that we think of the two together means our patients wind up taking medications that they don't need. And I mean, the case of calcium supplements, the main issues in terms of side effects are constipation and bloating, just swallowing these great big horse tablets.
Yes.
Whereas slipping down a vitamin D supplement, I mean, in New Zealand we typically use them once a month, it just depends on the doses you have available, is a very straightforward, easy thing to do. And as I said, if you're taking it in a reasonable dose, then it's without risk. That's not to say that most people actually need vitamin D supplements from frail elderly people in their homes and women who are permanently veiled, people in submarines. You know, vitamin D is all about sunshine exposure, and in Australia and New Zealand, most people have lots, but not everybody.
Why have they been conflated?
Well, I think it's because people started doing trials of the two together. And the one, if you like, truly successful trial was of calcium and vitamin D together in nursing home residents in France. And that was published in the early 90s. Was spectacularly successful in terms of fracture prevention. Another vitamin and D combined intervention, which was the Women's Health Initiative, carried out in 36,000 community dwelling women in North America, published 10 or 15 years later, showed absolutely no benefit whatsoever. And that's sort of the dichotomy that we have in this space. And I think in those particular trials, you can't tell, well, the one that was successful, you can't tell whether it would have been as successful if vitamin D alone had been given.
Mm.
But it wasn't. And from the other information that we have, probably it was the vitamin D that was the critically successful factor. I think the Women's Health Initiative, the huge study, was very important because what that tells us is if you're just taking ordinary older women living in the community, this is a waste of time. It achieves nothing. And it causes side effects.
Yes, well, we'll get to those shortly. What defines calcium deficiency, Ian?
Yeah, well, it's a term that's widely used and never defined, and that is a critical issue. It's very clear that when your vitamin D level gets below a certain level, and you can measure that in the blood, then the absorption of calcium from the diet and, as a result of that, the mineralization of your bones becomes compromised, and you get bone pain, and you have a number of other biochemical changes in your blood, which are fairly clearly laid out. And also, if you actually take a sample of bone, which we don't do very often these days, then you can see that bone is not mineralizing normally. So vitamin D deficiency can be defined, though again, there are disagreements about what's optimal and whatever. Calcium deficiency is a nebulous concept. Often it's thought about through the prism of a very Western eye. And so we sort of say, well, you know, in Holland, everyone has 1,100 milligrams of calcium a day. In Australia and New Zealand, they have 800-900 milligrams of calcium a day. And so you've really got to have these kinds of levels to be healthy. And we overlook completely that most of Africa and most of Asia, for the times that we know anything about their diet, because, you know, they have not traditionally been dairying areas, communities, have got by, as far as we can see, perfectly well on calcium intakes of 200 to 300 milligrams a day. And so the West is sort of locked into these ideas that what we do must be right. It's interesting, you can read articles from the 1980s and they talk about the calcium paradox, which was at that time described as being the fact that the low calcium countries have fewer fractures than the high calcium countries. Well, I think it's not entirely entirely a paradox. It just tells us there's something wrong with some of our assumptions. So I think knowing what the minimal healthy calcium intake is for your bones to be adequately mineralized is not at all clear. We know in parts of Africa, in growing children, when their calcium intakes get down to 100 milligrams a day, that they start having trouble growing their skeletons normally and they'll break. But the adults on those low calcium intakes actually appear to be okay. That's not to say we should be recommending those levels, but I think whereas in the past some groups in North America, for instance, have said postmenopausal women have to have 1,500 milligrams a day, and now they've brought that down, I think, to 1,200 milligrams a day. Mm. Other countries, such as the UK, say actually 700 milligrams a day is fine. I think on balance of evidence, and particularly some of the studies we've done where we've just followed rates of bone loss in quite a few hundred women and men, actually, over periods of 5 or 6 years, we don't see any influence of your self-selected dietary calcium intake on your rate of bone loss, even down to levels of 300 milligrams a day. So I wouldn't say the consensus focuses on 300, but I think we're now progressively, because we've changed the ways that we're trying to assess this, we're now actually finding answers that fit more with that real-world data, which is that if you're Chinese or Indian or Nigerian, you seem to do just fine on 300 milligrams a day. I think in terms of recommendations, I think certainly what we say in our article is you should aim to be more than 500 milligrams a day, and that's probably perfectly reasonable. It's actually what the community is consuming. We've got it through mass medication with calcium supplements, or certainly the North Americans have, through defining a requirement that bears no relationship to what people actually take, and then that leads to mass medication of the well members of the community.
So what are the risks of taking calcium or vitamin D when we don't need them?
Well, I think for calcium, it depends a bit how you take it. As far as we can tell, if you're on 2,000 milligrams a day in your diet, and you know there are some adolescent boys who sort of go out and exercise vigorously and then drink a litre of milk or so, there doesn't seem to be downsides from that. As I said, the Dutch have always been a very high dairy community and therefore a high calcium intake community, and they don't seem to have problems that others don't have. So I think dietary calcium is relatively safe, and I think just the fact that usually if you're getting calcium from your diet, it's coming together with protein and fat, and so you feel satiety, and so you don't binge on it. I think supplements are the problem. I think everyone who's taken supplements or prescribed supplements knows that people get constipated taking calcium supplements. You know, calcium is a key part of concrete, and it can sometimes have that effect on your bowel. That a lot of particularly calcium carbonate supplements, when you ingest them, you generate a whole lot of CO2, so people sort of get bloating and feel uncomfortable. And they're just actually difficult to swallow because they're quite large. And, you know, there is literature talking about people getting into significant issues with choking on calcium supplements and so on. So I think there are those pragmatic issues. The GI ones are not always trivial, and there's a study from Perth indicating that in the placebo group, I think 6% of people wound up in hospital with some sort of gastrointestinal emergency requiring admission to hospital, and that was doubled from 6% to 12% in the people randomized to calcium. So it does imply that if older people are taking these big doses of calcium as supplements, it's not always benign in terms of the gastrointestinal side effects you get. The Women's Health Initiative, the huge study that I mentioned, showed an increase in risk of kidney stones of about 20%, and we've inadvertently caused a lot of discussion, if you like, or disagreement, because we did a randomized controlled trial in which we specified heart attacks as one of the secondary endpoints we wanted to look at, because we actually thought that we might see a beneficial effect there. And in fact, we saw about a 30% increase in risk of heart attack.
Did that surprise you?
Well, it did. It appalled us, actually.
Yeah.
And so as a result, we went back and adjudicated each of those events with great care, and they were all bona fide events. And so it led us on to collect data from all the other big calcium trials and pull that together, and we again found about a 20% increase in risk of heart attack. That has upset some people. And so there have certainly been people who've said, no, we don't believe this is true at all. And we've sort of redone meta-analyses in slightly different ways and have come out with slightly different answers. But we believe that what we found is correct. There's been quite a lot of observational sort of studies which have produced mixed results. What perhaps has been most interesting is we think the way that a calcium supplement increases your risk of heart attacks is because when you take a calcium supplement, your blood calcium level goes up quite significant for about 6 to 8 hours after you've taken it, and then gradually your body gets things under control and you get back to where you were. And now there are some very big studies, some of them just purely observational, others using complicated genetic techniques, which have demonstrated that people who run higher blood calcium levels within the normal range have about a 20% increase in risk of heart attacks in comparison with people who run blood calciums in the lower part of the normal range. That observational data and the genetic studies called Mendelian randomization studies have produced a result very, very similar to what we found in our meta-analyses of randomized controlled trials. I think it provides a reasonable sort of mechanistic basis for the abnormalities we've found, because I think bone people have focused on the fact that calcium goes into bones and makes bones strong. But actually, there are a lot of other areas of medicine that have been very focused on the fact that atheromatous lesions in arteries have calcium in them. And belief has tended to be that calcium is just a passive part of that process. But I think there is evidence from a number of sources suggesting that actually if you load more calcium into those lesions, that you accelerate the sort of atherosclerotic process. A lot of cardiologists and a lot of nephrologists, for that matter, regard calcium, calcium loading, which is what we're really doing with supplements, as being a pathogenic contributor to vascular disease. So it remains controversial, but in some ways it's almost a non-issue, because bottom line is that calcium supplements don't reduce the risk of fractures in older people. So why would you use them in the first place?
Yep.
And the evidence that suggested that you needed very high levels of calcium for bone health basically came from calcium balance studies. You don't really find the same evidence now that we can actually measure bone density directly rather than using the very indirect process of calcium balance. We don't really find the same benefits from bone density studies. We also have big fracture studies now. So, there isn't a good case for giving calcium supplements for skeletal benefit for people on intakes of more than, say, 500 milligrams a day. So the whole issue of the safety of giving 500 or 1,000 milligrams of calcium as a supplement is, I think, increasingly a non-issue.
I'm chatting today with Professor Ian Reid from the University of Auckland. His co-authored narrative review of vitamin D and calcium supplements is available at mja.com.au. While you're there, don't forget to check out Insight Plus, the journal's weekly online news magazine. You'll find that at insightplus.mja.com.au, and all of the Insight content is open access. Back to our chat.
Vitamin D safety, as I said before, if you're giving the doses that are typically used in Australia and New Zealand, which is sort of 400 to 1,000 units of vitamin D a day, those are pretty small little capsules. They slide down easily. They don't push your vitamin. If you've got severe vitamin D deficiency, they will actually restore it to normal. If you've got a normal vitamin D, because your vitamin D level is very carefully controlled in your systems, you'll push it up a little bit, but not very much. And so the safety issues of that are basically non-existent. Costs of that are very low. And because it's a tiny little tablet, you don't get GI side effects from that. So that's fine. What's slightly more worrying is there have been some enthusiasts in the United States who've been saying, oh, no, you don't want to be taking 1,000 units a day. That's useless. You need to be taking 4,000 to 10,000 units. I think we've known from our own clinical experience that sometimes if you use those sorts of doses, people will get vitamin D intoxication, which is typically manifest as high blood calcium levels. And sometimes those high blood calcium levels stay up for a long, long time, and in days gone by, used to result in people going into renal failure and either going on to dialysis or dying. So big doses of vitamin D are potentially dangerous. What's become apparent in a couple of recent studies is that doses above about 4,000 units a day, to everyone's surprise, seem to increase your risk of having falls. They seem to increase your risk of having fractures. And now a study published only a few months ago indicating that it accelerates bone loss. And I think what the vitamin D enthusiasts have forgotten is that vitamin D is not primarily, in terms of its action in our bodies, a tonic for bone. It's a way in which we maintain our blood calcium levels.
Yes.
And if you drive vitamin D levels very high, it not only stimulates calcium absorption from the gut, but it stimulates calcium or bone resorption. So it turns on the bone-resorbing cells, the osteoclasts, so that calcium can be mobilized out of the skeleton. So at high intake,
yes,
vitamin D is bad for bone. But I think in New Zealand, Australia, there have not been advocates for those sorts of intakes, those sorts of supplements are not available across the counter. So that's not really an issue.
So that's a tick for vitamin D in some situations.
I think it's very clear if elderly people are put in institutions and they do not have direct access to sunlight, because the ultraviolet light we need to make vitamin D in our skin does not come through glass. So sitting in a picture window looking out at Sydney Harbour may be good for your spirits, but it does nothing for your vitamin D level. So people who are permanently indoors from whatever cause will become vitamin D deficient, and they need supplements. Otherwise, they will develop bone and muscle problems as a result of that deficiency. So yeah. I think in that context, the other context is dark-skinned people, particularly if they're veiled, living in relatively non-sunny places. And we saw epidemics of rickets in children in the 1950s, 1960s, when there was emigration from the Indian subcontinent to the north of Europe, the UK. That's a very real phenomenon. That's not something that's imagined. So I think we need to be aware of those situations where vitamin D deficiency is likely, and provide cheap, safe interventions in that context. One of the other issues is whether it's necessary to give calcium and vitamin D as part of a treatment package for osteoporosis. And what a number of the authorities in the area, if you like the International Osteoporosis Foundation, have said, yes, okay, we accept that calcium and vitamin D doesn't have a place as a routine supplement for community-dwelling older people, but it's very important that you give these things when you are treating osteoporosis, because all the trials that have been done in this area have done that.
Yep.
Well, that's not entirely true. So, I mean, there are several studies, including a large trial with intravenous bisphosphonates that we published at the end of last year, which have been done without any calcium supplements. And I think there is enough trial evidence that the drugs we commonly use for treating osteoporosis, which is the bisphosphonates, work perfectly well without co-administration of calcium. I think many of the drugs we use in treating osteoporosis, we would not want to give to people who are severely vitamin D deficient, because sometimes that can tip you over the edge into having a low blood calcium level, which can be symptomatic. So I think we need to think carefully about vitamin D deficiency when we're treating people's osteoporosis. Sure, if someone's got a totally calcium-free diet, then to think of some way of getting calcium into them, and this can often be done if someone's dairy-free, then they should, they can take soy milk or something like that, which is usually fortified with calcium. We should be thinking about that in people who've got very unusual diets, but for the most part, when we're treating osteoporosis with conventional drugs, we need to be ruling out vitamin D deficiency, but calcium supplements generally don't matter. There are one or two newer powerful drugs where it is true that the trials that have been done to date have all been done with calcium and vitamin D supplements, and we don't really know what happens with some of those newer drugs, and I'm talking about very small numbers of people taking these drugs at the present time. We don't really know what happens use those without calcium and vitamin D, so people should proceed with caution in that. But so there's a new drug called romosozumab, which produces enormous increases in your bone density, so you're making a lot of new bone, and maybe you do need extra calcium to achieve that. We don't know, because we haven't done studies yet without giving the calcium. So I think with some of the very new drugs on the market, we just need to be slightly more cautious. But with the bisphosphonates, like alendronate, Fosamax, as it's referred to, often there is quite a lot of data without calcium supplements, and it doesn't seem to make much difference. As long as vitamin D stays, this is fine. Well, thanks for your interest.
No worries at all.
All right.
Thank you. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.